we have these deep-seated beliefs that we like what we like, and that is the way we are. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, what you believe and what you believe you like is largely determined for you based on these habits of mind, right? Your political affiliation, your religion, your product preferences, the way you talk, the way you look, all of these things are not inborn.
Welcome to the User Defenders Podcast, where we interview successful UX designers who fight for the user in order to inspire and equip you to do the same. And now, here's your host, Jason Ogle.
Greetings, User Defenders. Welcome to this very special episode. I'm your host, Jason Ogle. I have a listener survey at userdefenders.com/survey, and one of you suggested Nir Eyal as a super guest. Well, today, thanks to your suggestion, I got to interview the man himself. Nir is the author of the buzzworthy book, Hooked, How to Create Habit-Forming Products. And Nir did not disappoint. The guy is a wealth of knowledge, and you'll see listening to him that he's definitely got his 10,000 hours focusing on the fascinating topic of behavioral design. So, how do we design products that hook our users and create healthy habits? Should designers of addictive and potentially unsafe products be a little more vocal about offering help to its users? We touch on these provocative topics and much more. So, without further ado, here's my interview with Nir Eyal. This episode is brought to you in part by Universal Mind, a digital design and consulting company based in Denver, Colorado. Picture the ideal state for your business. In a complex and ever-changing digital world, Universal Mind will help you get there through design thinking workshops, UX strategy and design, technology consulting, agile services, and software development. They also believe in supporting user defenders to train and inspire the next generation of designers. Learn more at universalmind.com. Nir Eyal is the author of Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He runs a popular blog about the intersection of psychology, technology, and business. His primary focus is on what he calls behavioral design, which encompasses user experience, behavioral economics, and a dash of neuroscience. He's taught at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and Design. He has sold 2 technology companies and now helps teams design more engaging products. For most of his career, he's worked in the video gaming and advertising industries where he learned, applied, and at times rejected the techniques used to motivate and manipulate users. He writes to help companies create behaviors that benefit their users while educating people on how to build healthful habits in their own lives. He received most of his education earning an advanced degree from the School of Hard Knocks, as well as an MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He also wrestled for 4 years in high school and never won a match. Looks like you chose a good fallback plan, Nir.
Yeah, exactly.
Welcome to User Defenders. I'm super excited to have you.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. And thanks for embarrassing me by mentioning my high school wrestling record.
Well, thanks for divulging that. I like to throw in a fun fact if possible. And that was a great one. So I appreciate your vulnerability.
You know, the reason I mentioned that is that the reason I told you about that was because, you know, it kind of alludes to why I'm so fascinated by habits. So the reason I never won a match in high school was that I was obese. I was clinically obese. I went to fat camp. I went to, you know, doctors. I remember my doctor showing my mom on the chart, okay, here's normal and here's your son way over here. across the line of clinically obese. And so I've always kind of been fascinated with how products, in my case, food, controlled me, you know,
interesting.
Or how I allowed it to control me and how I didn't understand as a child the power of our habits. And I think it actually illustrates why I'm so fascinated by the habits we all are so fascinated with when it comes to our technology products today, which is the subject of my book.
Wow. Oh, that's very fascinating, Nir. I appreciate you sharing that. Yeah. Now, some fat wrestlers do quite well, though.
That's true. But I was not. See, some fat
different
wrestlers
sport.
Have a lot of extra fat, but they also have a lot of muscle. I just have the fat without the muscle.
Nice. So for only the second time, I've decided to depart from my normal superhero format to talk about your amazing book. And it is amazing, and I highly recommend it to defenders listening to check out the book. Be sure to get it. It's
it opened my eyes in so many ways. And again, I think I tweeted out there, I said something about how only like a few chapters in, it's a total book quake. And I am totally serious about that. So it was just so well done, Nir. It's incredible. So what I've done is I really want to just talk about your book because there's so much to talk about. And so what I've done is I've kind of broken this this format into four particular areas. I've broken it into what, the bad, the good, and how. So I still want to start out with your origin story, Nir, and you kind of gave us a little glimpse into that as already, but I'd like to just know kind of what sort of events turned you into this behavioral design superhero, and hopefully they weren't tragic beginnings.
So, you know, I think, as I mentioned, I think I've always had a fascination with how products can change behavior. You know, we come into this world, nobody comes into this world as a baby with preferences around what they like. And yet we have these deep-seated beliefs that we like what we like, and that is the way we are. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, what you believe, and what you believe you like is largely determined for you based on these habits of mind, right? Your political affiliation, your religion, your product preferences, the way you talk, the way you look, all of these things are not inborn, right? We're not born with these preferences, that we form these preferences over time. And so that's really fascinating to me. And at my last company, I started two tech companies, and at my last company, we were at the intersection of gaming and advertising. And I just happened to find myself in the center of two industries that, you know, I'll admit to you now are dependent upon mind control, right? So advertisers don't spend billions of dollars for their health. They're doing it to influence your decision making in terms of what you're going to buy or not buy, hopefully their products. And game designers, I mean, there's probably no profession that is more steeped in the application of consumer psychology than game designers, who understand how to make you click based on what makes you tick. You know, they understand that stuff better than you understand yourself. And so I got to see from that vantage point of these two industries between gaming and advertising, these methods, these techniques being used. And so I just became fascinated with these techniques. And also I became fascinated with the fact that a lot of people in these two industries, you know, there wasn't this like secret manual, you know, this book that told them how to do this stuff. They just kept doing what had worked in the past, or maybe what they saw a competitor doing. But they couldn't really tell you why that technique worked, or you know, what was the psychology behind why one method worked and one method didn't. They just kind of kept doing what had always been done, or you know, copying others. And so I kind of wanted to write that book so that people outside those industries could use the same techniques for all sorts of things, right? So that it's not just advertisers and gaming companies and social networks that use persuasive technology and habit-forming technology. It's all sorts of companies, right? My hope is that we can use what I wrote in this book to help people build all kinds of healthy habits, right? There's no reason we can't use the same exact tactics for good. And so that's really why I wrote the book.
Awesome. A lot of good information in there, and definitely inspiring. And I believe it was Steven Tyler who said, if you want to write a hit song, get to the hook as quickly as possible. Now, the book centers around a concept you've coined, the hook cycle, which consists of triggers, action, variable reward, and investment. Now, can you walk us through each of these and their impact on designing habit-forming products?
Sure. So what I found in my research, my big question was, what is it about these products that over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years have kind of come out of nowhere and so profoundly changed users' lives? These products that start off as toys. When you think about the first time you saw Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or WhatsApp, I mean, all of these products, even Slack to some degree, you know, they were all products that were dismissed. Another one of those social networks, another one of those products. We've seen it. It's just a silly toy. It's never going to be anything serious. And yet these companies became world-changing companies that created billions of dollars of shareholder value and touched the lives of hundreds of millions, if not billions, of users. And so my key question was, is there something in common with these companies? You know, what is it about these companies that can so profoundly change user behavior? If you're in business, if you're in product design, if you're a UX designer, you know how hard it is to change consumer behavior. And yet these companies have done it on a massive scale, never before seen. And so I really want to get at the heart of how do they do it? What is it about Facebook that makes it so sticky? Why, you know, not just Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, WhatsApp, all these companies I mentioned, are there common elements? And it turns out there is. The common element is called the hook. And the hook is an experience designed to connect the user's problem with the company's product with enough frequency to form a habit. And these hooks are embedded into the product design. It literally is the user experience. The flow that users go through in using the product touches these four steps to form these core habits. And it's through successive cycles through these hooks that customer preferences are shaped, that our tastes are formed, and that these habits take hold. So I'll give you kind of the 30,000-foot overview of the hook model.
Sure.
Just to kind of set the stage a bit. So I'll do a very, very quick run through. Of course, the whole book is based on these four steps, so there's a lot more to it than I can encapsulate in a few minutes, but I'll try my best here. So the trigger is all about, first and foremost, the internal trigger. There's two types of triggers, internal and external triggers, but the internal trigger is the most important. The internal trigger is a piece, something in the user's life that prompts them to action through some kind of association, right? So when I'm in a certain place, a certain situation, a certain routine, and most often when I feel a certain type of emotion, prompts me to action. And so that's probably the most fundamental and most important question that someone building a habit-forming product needs to ask is, what's my internal trigger? What's the behavior that – well, I'm sorry, what's the thing that occurs frequently enough in the user's life that I'm going to attach to? Now, the most frequently occurring internal triggers are emotions, but not just any emotion. They are negative emotions. So when I'm feeling bored, lonely, fatigued, lost, indecisive, any of these – negative emotions, these are pain points. These are things that we as product designers want to solve for. That's kind of our mission in life. Our professional life should be to fix consumers' pain. And so we've got to identify that pain on a psychological level, right? What's that itch? What's that pain point that we want to associate our product with? So when I'm lonely, before even thinking about it, I'm checking Facebook or maybe Tinder. Right. When I'm uncertain, I'm Googling, right, with little or no conscious thought. When I'm bored, I mean, geez, you know, when I'm bored, there's so many potential things I might associate that with. I might go to YouTube. I might check the news. I might check stock prices, sports scores. All of these things cater to this painful internal trigger of boredom. Hmm. So that's the ultimate end goal of a habit-forming product, is to form an association with an internal trigger. To get there, we have to use these external triggers. External triggers are things that tell the user what to do next with some piece of information in the environment, right? So this is kind of the standard fare of what designers do. Click here, buy now, play this. All of these things tell the user what to do next with some piece of information. So it starts with an external trigger, but through successive cycles through the hook, we no longer need those external triggers. Eventually, we become prompted just through these internal triggers, and that's really when the habit is formed. So that's all about the trigger phase. The next step is the action phase, which is defined as the simplest behavior done in anticipation of a reward. Mm-hmm. And here it's really all about how simple you can make doing the habit. And I can't emphasize this enough. I mean, all technological innovation, if you want to, what's the definition of technology? Technology is all about shortening the distance, shortening the work between the recognition of the need and the solution, right? I don't care if it's a cotton gin or the iPhone. All technology does that fundamental job of shortening the work between the recognition of the need and the solution. So that's your job as a designer, is how can we radically simplify the steps the user takes to get relief from that emotional itch, from that need, from that painful internal trigger. There's all kinds of things that we could talk about with it when it comes to the action phase, but let's move on for the sake of time.
Sure.
To the next step of the hook, which is the variable reward phase. This is where the user's itch is actually scratched. So the action is the habit they do to get relief. The reward phase of the hook is where they actually get the relief. And what's interesting about the reward phase is that it's not just about giving the user what they want. It's also about adding a bit of uncertainty, mystery. I shouldn't say just adding. It's either adding or leveraging existing variability. So the reason I talk about variability is that there's this really fascinating line of research that starts with B.F. Skinner, the father of operant conditioning back in the 1940s and 50s. Skinner took these pigeons And in his famous experiments, he gave these pigeons a little pellet, a food pellet, a reward, every time they pecked at a disc. So at first, he would, you know, see them peck at the disc, and they would receive a reward, right? That's called operant conditioning. So he could train the pigeon to peck at the disc on a predictable schedule. But then he did something different, right? Sometimes when the pigeon pecked at the disc, they would not receive a reward. The next time, they would receive a reward. And by having that variability, by having that bit of mystery, a bit of the unknown, what Skinner observed was that the rate of response, the number of times these pigeons pecked at the disc, increased when the reward was given on a variable schedule of reinforcement. And that principle, once you recognize it, it's kind of one of those, for me it was, and I hear this from people who have read the book, that's kind of an unplugging from the matrix moment. When you realize how much of human behavior is about trying to deal with variability. It's what makes romance fun. It's what makes jokes funny. It's what makes books interesting. It's what makes movies worth watching and sports something that engages us. And of course, it's at the core of habit-forming technologies. It's all about this variability. So when you think about, for example, probably the kind of first thing that people think about when they think about variable rewards is gambling. Right, when you play on a slot machine, there's this variability about what you might win. That's what makes playing a game of chance fun. So when you pull on the handle of that slot machine, you're not sure if you're going to win or not. That's the variability. And of course, you're watching intently to see if you're going to win. And that same exact psychology is at work online. So when we think about the feed, for example, your Facebook feed, your Twitter timeline, your LinkedIn feed, all of these things fundamentally utilize the same mechanic of variability. You're not sure what you're going to see once you keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. So that's the variable reward phase. So either companies want to insert variability to make the experience more enjoyable, or they want to take a situation that's inherently variable and give the user greater agency and control. We can talk about the distinction there. Not every product wants to insert it. Some products want to actually leverage existing variability. Finally, the last step of the hook is the investment phase. And this is probably the most overlooked because a lot of companies think, well, all we have to do is give the user what they want. That's done. Let them go, right? Just get them to check out, pay, gone. But if you're not asking the user to invest, to put something into the product, that's the fourth step of the hook, the investment phase. You're really missing on a huge opportunity. And investment is not money. Actually, monetization is the last form of investment. Other forms of investment are things that the user does for a future benefit, right? It's something I do to make the product better with use so that I'm more likely to come back and use it in the future. And investments do this in two ways. The first way that investments make the product make me more likely to use them in the future is by loading the next trigger. So something that the user does to bring themselves back. So for example, when I use WhatsApp, or Slack, or any number of other messaging services, just as an example, when I send someone a message, I am loading the next trigger because I'm likely to get a reply. And that reply may not come immediately, right? It may take a little while, but I'm loading the next trigger for the company to send me, I'm sorry, for the person that I sent the message to send me a message back, which sends me a notification. That's an example of an external trigger that prompts me to use the product again, that prompts me to go through the hook and use the product again. So that becomes the external trigger for the next pass through the hook. The other way that investments increase the likelihood of coming back to use the product is that they store value. And this is a really big deal. I think this is a huge, huge opportunity when it comes to using interactive products, is stored value is this principle that I coined where the more we use a product, the better it becomes. It appreciates in value. So when you think about how different physical products are, right? Things made out of atoms as opposed to things made out of bits. Things in the physical world, like your clothing, your chair, your table, all of these things in the physical world, they lose value with wear and tear, right? They depreciate. Yeah. But habit-forming products should do the opposite. Habit-forming products should appreciate in value. They should get better and better the more we use them because of this concept of stored value. And they do this because of the more content we put in them, the more data we add to them, the more followers we accrue, the more reputation we build. All of these four things are forms of stored value that make the product better and better with use until even if a competitor with a better product comes along, your customer will still use you. And this is why this is such a big deal, because there is no rule that I have ever seen that says the best product wins. In fact, that's a lie. People think, well, if I just build the prettiest, the best product, it'll win. And then they don't understand why their product doesn't win the market, because there is no such rule. There is no 11th commandment that says the best product wins. You know, Silicon Valley Deadpools are full of companies that had the best product, but they lost because the incumbent had the habit. The competition owned the monopoly of the mind. And that is what carries the day, is the company that can form that habit is the company that wins.
Wow. That was very, very well spoken, Nir. And I'm glad you ran through that because, like you said, too, this, I mean, you were able to write a whole book on all four of these points. So there's so much more to each of these points. But I appreciate you giving us the 30,000 foot view on those, because it really does establish kind of where we're going to go with this conversation. So I really appreciate it. And I was also thinking about a couple things, about the variable reward. SeaWorld has done pretty well with that, with the variable rewards. That's probably controversial, though, with the animals and stuff. But and then I thought about, about the investment, and does anybody ever get 100% LinkedIn completion on their profile? It's always like 99%. You're almost there, but there's
Good
nothing
question.
Left for you to do. But it's kind of like the whole Amazon scarcity effect, too. I think it's kind of like if they change that, well, then maybe you wouldn't be as engaged. I don't know. But then I thought about the appreciation. I wish my Zynga stock would appreciate.
Don't hold your breath on that one.
I'm not going to.
That actually brings up a good question, though. I mean, I get this question sometimes of like, look, okay, so variable rewards, that's what's supposed to keep products engaging. But, what about Farmville? What about Zynga, right? Aren't games full of variable rewards? So what explains the fact that we're not still playing Super Mario Brothers and Pac-Man and Farmville, for example? What happened?
Right.
And why I predict that Pokemon Go will also be a fad. And the reason for this is, think about it, right? Do you actually hold Zynga stock, by the way?
I do. I'm embarrassed
to
say
it. Okay, so sorry. I don't want to.
Only 10 shares. Only 10 shares.
Okay. Well, it can't go down much more, I hope, because apparently their market cap is less than the value of their real estate. So
it went up like
go much more.
It went up like 30 cents over the past 5 years or something.
Okay. So I think this is a really fascinating question of like, what happened to these products that were super habit forming and then no longer engaging?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you think about it, let's take Farmville, for example, as a good case study, right? So Farmville back in 2008 was the fastest growing game in history. It was the Pokemon Go of its time. Mm. Everybody was playing Farmville.
Yep.
And then what happened next, right? So what was the next thing that Zynga released into the market after Farmville? I think it was Chefville or Cityville. Cityville. And then after Cityville came Frontierville and then Chefville and then Farmville 2 and then the nextville and the nextville and the nextville. And what was once variable, right? What was once unpredictable became very predictable. And when something becomes predictable, it becomes boring. So those kind of games are experiences that I call examples of finite variability. Now, finite variability is when an experience becomes more predictable with use, as opposed to an experience that is infinitely variable, where it does not become more predictable with use. So if you think about, a book, a movie, a game, the more you interact with it, when you get to the end of the book, when you finish the movie, when you play the game for a while, you know what's going to happen, right? Very few movies do we go see in a movie theater, walk out the front door of the movie theater, and go right back in and watch it again. Why? Because we just saw it. We know what we know all the punchlines. We know how the movie concludes. We know what's going to happen and how the happy ending is going to resolve itself. And there's no reason to go back because we know what's going to happen, right?
Yeah.
It's not fun, right? It's like when people watch sports and they tape it on TiVo or something, they don't want you to tell them who won the game,
right?
Because it spoils it for them.
Ah.
So those are examples of finite variability. And so this is what's going to happen with Pokemon Go, is that unless they figure out ways to make the experience more variable, if it's always just about doing the same thing, just, battling Pokemon, that's going to get old after a while.
Mm.
However, if they insert battles with your friends, if they make it a social aspect to it, right? Our friends are constantly changing, right? This is why Facebook continues to be so engaging and so habit forming, because what you can see on Facebook is much more variable, right? Your friends are going on vacation, they're posting articles, they're taking pictures. There's much more variability about what you might find every day on a Facebook or YouTube than a game with finite variability. It doesn't mean it's a bad business, right? It's not that finite variable rewards are bad and infinite variable rewards are good. It's just that your business needs to be structured to take that into account. So for example, books and movies and video games, these are studio models. So they're constantly cranking out the new thing, right? It's not like you can make a movie if you're a movie studio and say, okay, we're going to have an asset that is, you know, we're going to print one book or make one movie and it's going to pay all of our, provide cash flow forever. No, these things are experienced and then they're kind of consumed and then people don't consume them again. That's fine, but you constantly have to be cranking out new content, right? New stuff. So you just have to set yourself up for that model as opposed to Facebook, right? Facebook is still fundamentally Facebook and it has been for years. Because the content itself is constantly changing, not the product itself.
Fascinating. Fascinating that a lot of these addictive products, particularly social media, is—it's really the variable reward is other people's content. It's user-generated. That variable reward is people that we have some sort of relationship with, and so I think Facebook has done really well at kind of bringing in a lot of these hooks into their products. So I think that's very fascinating. But I think, you know, about the finite variability, I keep waiting for that to happen with the movie Frozen with my kids. I don't think that's going to happen. But anyway,
that's a really good point. It will happen eventually. I promise.
Okay.
You know, stick with me. It will happen eventually. But kids, you know, if you think about it, why does that happen with kids? I get that question sometimes. Uh-huh. Well, if that's true, why are they obsessed? Well, just the fact that they've seen less, right?
Oh, yeah.
You've seen these cliches over and over again, right? In the thousands of movies you've watched, and the thousands of stories and books you've seen, you've kind of seen these things again and again, whereas a child is still new in the world, right? It's still fascinating because they just haven't been exposed to it as many times.
Yeah. Oh, that makes perfect sense.
So let them play it ad nauseum, because the sooner they get it, the sooner they memorize, the sooner they'll get over it.
Love it. I'm going to take that encouragement and try to apply it at home. So now let's segue into the bad. And this is one that really strikes a lot of chords with me, because there's a lot of bad things, unfortunately, that have happened as a result of some of these addictive products, and I just want to touch on that subject matter. I want to end with the good because I'm an optimist. So, and there is a lot of good. I know that you're gonna shed a lot of light on that. But for the bad, we can't avoid that. We can't turn our heads the other way. But you know, I love this in the book. You're saying that building habit, because we know building habit-forming products can be a superpower. As one of your blog readers commented, if it can't be used for evil, it's not a superpower. I love that. And it's a nice kind of tie into the show, too. We talk about superpowers a lot.
A Spider-Man quote, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, with great power comes great responsibility.
Right,
so,
exactly.
So I feel like we should talk a little bit about that. And here's just a few things that I did a little research. You know, 76% of 13 to 24-year-olds are addicted to digital devices. That should come as no major surprise. You know, and that's a study from Civic Science in July 2016. But these next two are from your book. You know, 79% of smartphone owners check their phones within 15 minutes of waking up. And fully one third of all Americans said they would rather give up sex than their cell phones. Well on our way to extinction. So I just think about a 2014 study found that cell phones are responsible for 1 in 4 crashes. And I couldn't help in my research to discover, I'm not a Snapchat user. I tried it. I didn't understand the UI, to be honest with you. But their miles per hour feature, I didn't even know this existed. But there's people that are dying because they're using this feature and being distracted and trying to show off. And, you know, and I just think of one story in particular. Three young women from Philadelphia died because they were, and one of them was a mother to a school-aged son, and they were believed to be using, I don't have evidence or anything, but they're believed to be using that feature because that was the last snapshot that was posted, was an MPH showing how fast they were going, and they, you know, ran into a fuel truck or something and burned alive. So the crazy thing about this MPH feature is that it's juxtaposed with a, quote, don't snap and drive, end quote, warning, which I think is awesome. I do think that's great that they're doing that. But the problem I have, it's more of a matter of principle, that Snapchat still designed a feature that encourages a behavior they're quote-unquote trying to discourage on the same page. And I feel like that's like holding an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in a bar. To me, that was kind of what my takeaway on that. But there are, of course, many other tragedies that have occurred as a result of addictive apps. Like another one that comes to mind is the current craze of extreme selfies with the young people. They're trying to capture pictures of themselves on top of high structures, and often quite a few fall to their death. So this leads me to my question. You know, you say companies, quote, companies building habit-forming products have a moral obligation to make sure their users don't have an unhealthy use of their products, end quote. Now, my question is, should companies creating addictive products such as Instagram, Snapchat, and even Facebook, for example, should they take a little more responsibility in communicating their addictive nature and things that have and could occur from addictive, distracted usage? Not unlike cigarette companies, they have to put a disclaimer on the packaging. So that's my really long setup to that question.
So it's a really big question, and I think it's a fascinating question. I think ethics is something that's really kind of captured a lot of my mind share over the past few years. I think it is important, though, to put this stuff in perspective. There's a big difference between a habit and an addiction, and I hate it when people affiliate addiction with my book, because I consciously did not call the book How to Build Addictive Products. I called the book How to Build Habit-Forming Products for a reason. And that reason is that an addiction is a persistent compulsive dependency on a behavior or substance that hurts the user. Okay. So it's something that hurts you and you can't stop doing even if you want to. That definition is very different from a habit. A habit is just an impulse to do a behavior with little or no conscious thought. And we have good habits as well as bad habits, whereas addictions are always bad. Addictions always hurt the user. So I would never want anyone to create a product intended to addict others. So the moral responsibility I do think companies have is that I have two rules for ethical design. They're pretty simple. And really, it's just one rule, but there's a corollary to that rule. So the second rule is that if we know someone is addicted and wants to stop, we have a responsibility to help them. So I think if a company knows that a user is addicted, meaning we ask them, we say, hey, would you like help cutting back your use? And if they say, yes, I would, then we have a moral responsibility to try and help them to moderate their use. And to me, that leaves me pretty optimistic, because remember, you know, people have been addicted and abusing all sorts of substances. So if you were an alcohol distiller, you could throw up your hands and say, well, I don't know who the alcoholics are, right? How do I know who's abusing my product, right? Mm-hmm. And you would be right. How would you know? Or even a cigarette manufacturer. I mean, you don't have any connection. You don't have any personal identifiable information about who's excessively using your product. So that's the way addictive products used to be used. But I'm optimistic because today, things are different. The beauty of this interactive technology, the upside, the silver lining to all this personal data that's being collected on us is that if these companies wanted to do something about the addicts, they could, right? If Reddit, if Facebook, if Twitter, whatever, a gaming company, Zynga, wanted to say, hey, look, you know, you're using this product a ton, right? You're using it 50, 60 hours a week. Maybe you'd like help cutting back. Can we help you cut back? And if the user says no, you know, that's not, there's nothing we can do. We shouldn't be Big Brother here and saying, no, you know, your consumption is bad, but you know, that's not our job, I think, as product designers. But if we ask and the user says, yes, please help me. So for example, I work with game, or not anymore, but I used to work with game companies, and I talk to game companies about ethics from time to time. And this happens, right? People will call a gaming company like Zynga, for example, and they will ask, look, cut me off, please. I do not want to keep using this product. It's not helping me, but I have this compulsive problem. Can you please not allow me back in? So if a customer asks that, I think we have an ethical obligation to do just that. Now, that being said, for the vast majority of people, these products are not addictive. And here's the test to figure out if a product is an addiction or not. The test is pretty simple. Basically, does the product harm me and can I stop using? Okay. If the answer is it harms me and I cannot stop using, that's an addiction. That's where we need outside help. And I think companies have a responsibility to do something about it. However, if the answer is, look, it doesn't harm me or I can't stop using, then I think it's a personal responsibility issue, right? I am as guilty as anyone of sometimes using too much Facebook, right? Where it's I should be doing something else. I should be reading a book that's on my desk. I should be, you know, spending time with my family. But sometimes I watch YouTube or Facebook. Now, is it really harming me? You know what? Let's say it is. But can I stop? Of course I can, right? I'm not addicted. I just need to have some self-control. And that's nothing new, right? Socrates and Aristotle debated the nature of what they called akrasia, this tendency that we have as human beings to do things against our better interests. That's nothing new, right? That's always been the case. And so the reason these products are hard to resist is because they're good, right? Mm. The reason we like them so much is because they're really good at doing their job of being useful, of being entertaining, of being something that we want to use. So that's not necessarily a problem. That's progress. I mean, look, let's flip it around. Would we want it any other way? Would we want these products to be things that we don't want to use? Of course not. That doesn't make any sense. We want these products to be great. Now, the downside, of course, right, is that technology makes things better. That's the natural course of a capitalist society where products go out to the free market to try and attract customers, is that they try and get better and better to attract more customers and more users. And that's, of course, a good thing. We want that, right? Remember, you know, Facebook and Skype that we're talking over right now, these tools, what are we really complaining about? I mean, if you take a step back, it's the most first world problem I could possibly think of, that we're moaning about these products being so good, these free products that don't cost us a dime. They're so good, we can't stop using them. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous when you take a step back. They're this good. That's by design. They're supposed to be good. And it's a miracle that we can talk halfway across the world over these free products and communicate. And I think for the vast majority of people, these things don't harm them and they can stop if they find that they're encroaching on their lives. They cut back. That's what the vast majority of people do. Now, are there some situations where people abuse a product or use it in a stupid way, like, you know, when people go 100 miles an hour on the highway with Snapchat? You know, people have been abusing products and using them in foolish ways forever. I'm pretty sure that, you know, when the first caveman made the first wheel, the caveman next to him said, "Ooh, that's dangerous. You know, don't do that." You know? So, and he's right, right? Like, you know, there's a great quote in that, and the person who said it, his name is escaping me, but somebody said that the first person who invented the ship also invented the shipwreck, right? That this is what technology does. There's always a downside to technology. Yeah. But of course, the answer to bad technology is more technology. And that sounds ironic, but of course, that's always been what happens, right? So mm-hmm. when there's one revolution, when there's one technological advancement, it always creates bads. It always creates negative aspect. But of course, you know, we wouldn't want to go back. None of us want to turn back the clock on the information age. We don't want to give up our iPhones and all the fantastic apps that have come with it. We don't want to turn back the clock and go back to an age before industrialization. We certainly don't want to go back before the agrarian revolution and all become hunter-gatherers. But of course, each of these technological leaps also came with bad aspects. So what we do is we fix the aspects of one generation of technology with the next generation of technology, right? We figure out ways. So for example, my problem that I discussed to answer your question in the beginning around overusing. Sometimes I find I'm on Facebook too much or I'm on YouTube too much. Well, here's what I did, right? First of all, I looked at the hook model and I tried to figure out how I could use the hook model, those same basic four steps that these products are built to be habit forming. How could I break that very same hook? So how could I remove the triggers? How could I make the action more difficult? How could I delay the rewards and how could I make sure I don't invest? It's the same exact four steps, but I use them in reverse. I break the habits I don't want. And part of the solution is this trend, this industry trend that I call attention retention devices. There are all these technologies, all these apps that are fixing the bad aspects of the last generation. So, for example, I don't just use YouTube. When I'm on YouTube now, I have this Chrome extension on my browser that removes all the junk on the side, right? All those triggers trying to get me to watch the next video. I just install this simple Chrome extension that deletes all that. I use ad blockers. On Facebook, I have another Chrome extension that's called Facebook Newsfeed Eradicator. I don't want to see my newsfeed. It's too distracting. Mm-hmm. So I have this Chrome extension that deletes that. When I'm writing, I use an app called Freedom that cuts off my internet when I have my sacred writing time so I can think. And I think we all are finding ways to put technology in its place. It doesn't mean that technology is bad. It doesn't mean that it's evil. It's just that we have to learn how to live with it and still get what we want. And so for the vast majority of people, this is a natural process. Like the fact that you even ask me that question, the fact that it's on so many people's minds is exactly what should be happening. We should be asking ourselves, wait a minute, is this all good for us? I mean, this is a big reason why I wrote this book is one, I want to help people build habit-forming products to build healthy habits. Yeah. But two, the hidden subtext here is that when you read the book, you know, you kind of scratch your head and say, holy shit, this is happening to me, right? These companies are doing this to me.
Yep.
And so that's great. I want people to do that. That's the natural evolution of these things so that we can put technology in its place. We can figure out how to use it the right way in a way that benefits us as opposed to controls us.
Mm. Awesome.
Hi, this is Victor Yakub, UX researcher and author of Design for the Mind. You're listening to the User Defenders podcast with Jason Ogle. Jason works tirelessly to bring you insight from the top names in UX so you can put the kapow on bad design.
Now, Nir, you noted some examples of unethical hooks that you see out there, i.e. dark patterns. And my friend Victor Yako, who's a psychologist, also and a researcher, he was encouraging me to ask this question, and I was like, I already had it on my thing, but I was definitely curious. So, what are some examples that you're seeing, particularly? So, if we're asked to create them, we can articulate why we're pushing back as designers.
Right. So, you know, this is something I would love your help actually to figure out how to propagate this. So, I spent a lot of time thinking about what should be the answer to the question. What won't we do? All right. I think every designer should have that as a credo in their mind around what they won't do. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't be financially successful doing whatever your boss wants you to do, right? Yeah. I'm not saying that you have to be ethical in order to succeed. In fact, you probably could make a lot of money not being ethical. But if you're the kind of person who asks themselves, look, how do I make sure I use my craft to benefit humanity, right? How do I use my limited time on Earth to make an impact, to help people? That's what I want to do with my time on Earth. And you care about ethics, then I provide, I think, what is it, a good ethical test to say, what won't I do? And the answer to that I've come up with, and I'm happy to hear criticism and adapt this, what won't we do? The answer to that is we don't design behaviors that the user wouldn't do if they knew everything that we know.
Hmm.
And in that one statement, that let me repeat that again.
Yeah, please.
That we don't design behaviors that the user wouldn't do if they knew everything that we know. Hmm. Meaning we the designer, we the company.
Yeah.
And that one statement encompasses what's dark about all dark patterns. All dark patterns, all scams, all tricks. All coercion, by the way, coercion as opposed to persuasion. Persuasion is when we help people do things they want to do. Coercion is when we get people to do things they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. Coercion is fundamentally when we get people to do things they don't want to do by hiding the negative aspects. So the rule is pretty simple, actually. If we ask ourselves, what is it about dark patterns that's dark? What is it about these unethical practices? It's fundamentally keeping the information about what's going to happen outside the user's consciousness.
That's good.
So that to me is, now again, I've been working on this for years, but I don't know if that's the only answer. I think it could probably be shorter. And I was looking for something that's really concrete and concise. And I think it's fundamentally that, which actually encompasses that unethical practice I told you earlier about it. If we know that someone is addicted, then we have a responsibility to help them. That it also encompasses that as well. To me, that would fall under that rubric.
That's awesome. I wrote something a while back about simplicity in design and how you can actually design something that's too simple and it could actually cost your users. So I think that it could also kind of tie into the dark patterns. You know, we should try to create great experiences for them, but try not to cost them something without their consent, right? I'm thinking about especially morally, but also financially.
Right. Yeah. And that's fundamentally the kind of stuff that people get pissed off about. Because I found that a lot of like ethical considerations, I've heard a lot of people, like my friend Tristan Harris's, you know, this time well spent movement. I like it. I think it's a great idea to kind of ask ourselves as users, how are we spending our time wisely? But from a designer perspective, I think it falls short because how can I get in the mind of the user to know what is time well spent for them, right? Like, I want to be mindless sometimes. I want to watch a movie and suspend disbelief. When my kid watches a magic show, the whole fun of that is I know it's a trick. Everyone knows it's a trick. But it's not that tricking someone is necessarily wrong. It's that I want to be tricked. I know it's a trick, and yet I want to be entertained, right? If I'm watching a film, I know that's not Brad Pitt actually doing what he's, you know, he's an actor, right? He's acting that. That's not a real person going through what this actor is portraying. I mean, even the screen is a big fat lie. That's not a real person. That's flickers of light on a screen.
Yeah.
But these are occasions when we want to be tricked. That's not a dark pattern. That's persuasive design. So it's only when, if I knew everything the designer knew, would I still want to do this? And I think that's kind of a good test for what we won't do. We won't design those behaviors that if the user knew everything that I know, that they wouldn't do it.
So let's move into the good parts. I'll just kind of start with a couple of things of really big takeaways that I got from your book, and then I'd love for you to give us some examples. But I just thought about how the first to mind solution wins, which is really great. I mean, we are designers, but we're working for people who are paying us, right? And we want to help them prosper. We want to help our companies prosper, and the business is often the forgotten user, to be honest, and the empathy factor. So I think that's a great point. You know, we want to build habit forming products because we want to help our companies be successful. So first to mind solution wins, for sure. Hooked users become product evangelists, which is great. I think that's a really great point. And we want people to talk about our products. We want people to be delighted with our products and for it to solve some pain points and problems. Fully agree. And then also habits keep users loyal. So I think that those are really big takeaways for me. You know, I will argue though that social media users, that's a question about loyalty, because I think that we're some of the most fickle users in the world. And I know firsthand because I worked at MySpace when everything fell apart and Facebook came along and just had a better solution. And so people were willing to change their behavior, but it didn't happen overnight. It was it was a defection. You know, people left and they started inviting, hey, it's better over here, you know, and then MySpace kind of became an abandoned amusement park in many ways. But but all I have to say, I mean, in general, overall, I think besides social media, I think that I agree with you that it definitely does keep users loyal. But you said that habit forming products can do far more good than harm. Now, can you talk about that some more, Nir, and give us some examples?
Sure. So I put my money where my mouth is, and I invest in companies that I see building healthy user habits. And I've invested in several companies as an angel investor that I see using these habits for good. One company there's many of these examples, but one company that comes to mind is a company called Seven Cups, which was started by a therapist, a psychotherapist by the name of Glenn Moriarty. And Glenn called me a couple of years ago. I do these office hours where anybody can call and we just chat about, you know, whatever. They read the book and they have a question and they're trying to apply the lessons in the book. Then, you know, we just talk for 15 minutes. And Glenn called me on one of these office hour sessions that I do. And he said, look, you know, I know a lot of people would benefit from my services, but they don't come to me, right? It's too difficult. And so when he read my chapter on the action phase of the hook, he immediately realized that he wasn't able to service people who needed his skills because It was too difficult. There was too many things in the way, right? It's expensive. It's time-consuming to find the right doctor. There's social stigma around it. There's a lot of barriers that make it difficult to get care. So Glenn came up with this app called Seven Cups, and I'll walk you through the hook. The internal trigger is feeling down, right? The internal trigger is when I need someone to talk to. Maybe I'm the parent of a child with a disability. Maybe I'm a veteran suffering from PTSD, or I'm just a person who just feels bad and depressed. I need someone to talk to. Well, I can open this app and anonymously, with just a click of a button, for no money, it's free, I can be connected to another human being who is ready to listen to me. And that's, so the action phase is very, very easy. The variable reward is rewards of the tribe. I'm connected to another person, so that's the reward of the tribe. And they're on the other line, this person who's ready to talk. Now, the investment phase is this is where it gets really interesting, is that the investment phase here is when people call to be listened to, they're also offered the opportunity to be trained as listeners. And the more they invest in learning how to be a listener on the platform, they get better themselves. So these people who come to be listened to treat themselves in a way. They get better by helping others. And not only do they get better, they get a lot better. A third-party study that was just published in a medical journal found that Seven Cups is as effective as traditional psychotherapy. I mean, talk about the amazing power of these habit-forming products. I think that's a great demonstration of how we can use these habits for good.
That's really great. And I think about in my own life about a product that's really been very beneficial for me. And because I used to be a little portly, too. I was probably about 50 pounds overweight. And I got this Fitbit thing on my wrist and the app. And then I started paying attention, more attention to kind of what I was doing. But I wasn't having to really do a lot of work, kind of like your great example in the book about Fitbit versus MyFitnessPal. Where you have to really, MyFitnessPal is just a lot of work, a lot of thinking, and it's hard to keep up. And then you feel bad when you don't log what you've eaten and things like that. And you start to feel accountable to your to your app and stuff. So
yeah.
Fitbit was really great for me. I lost 40 pounds. I feel
wow.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I think that's another example of a really great habit forming product.
It sounds like, did you change your diet as well or just
I
exercise?
I did. Yeah. Oh, so okay. I just basically, it was really simple. Like, because there's so many diet programs, and I'm not knocking anybody who tries the diet programs, but for me, it's like all I did was cut sugars, like unnatural sugars, and started exercising 30 minutes Monday through Friday. That was it.
Yeah.
That was all I did, and drank
it.
A lot of water. And of course, the Fitbit was really helped motivate me as well. But that's just one example that I can tell my own story on of a product that's really helped create a good habit. Yeah.
Terrific. I'm glad to hear that worked out. That's terrific.
Thanks, man.
As you know, today's special episode is all about Nir Eyal's amazing book, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. I definitely think you should read it, and I'd be remiss if I didn't offer you an easy way to do that. In fact, it's how I was able to read it twice in a matter of 2 weeks leading up to the interview. I did it through Audible on 1.5x speed. Now, since we love audio, I found it to be such a convenient and good habit-forming way to consume books. Here's the hook, if you will. If you try Audible for free, if you haven't already, using my affiliate link, you can get the Hooked audiobook absolutely free and keep it even if you decide to cancel your trial. It helps you, it helps me, and it helps Nir. Everybody wins. Try Audible for free today by visiting userdefenders.com/freebook.
So I know we're kind of coming up on the end of our time, so I want to make sure we get to the how part. Internal triggers, how do we discover our users' internal triggers?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think it's probably one of the most important questions is figuring out what your user's itch really is. There's a few techniques I describe in the book. There's the five whys technique that I didn't invent.
Love that.
It's a great, you've heard of it. I'm sure it's, asking fundamentally why someone would do a particular behavior until you get down to a core human need. That's one technique. Another technique I like that Jack Dorsey, one of the co-founders of Twitter and Square, espouses is building a narrative, is almost making like this play, this story of here's our user. And of course, it's not just a story you make up. It's a story that's verified based on a real persona of here's this person, here's where they are, and here's when they feel the need that we're going to address. And so by building that story, by building that user narrative, you can understand, is that itch really felt? And so that's a process that he espouses that I talk about in the book as well. So those are two techniques. Another way is to look for nascent behaviors. I always ask companies that I'm either working with or investing in, how is the problem currently solved? And sometimes I'll get, a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed entrepreneur here in Silicon Valley that says, no, Nir, you don't understand. There has never been a solution for this problem before. Nobody's touched it. And they think it's a good thing. But I'm always very skeptical, because if you can't tell me how that problem is being solved today, and by the way, it doesn't mean you need a competitor who's using, the same technology and building it the same way you are. I love seeing companies that are tackling a problem that users are currently solving with, six different Excel docs stitched together and scotch tape and bubble gum. That's great. Yeah. I love those type of solutions. But if you can't come up with any way that this problem is solved today, how that internal trigger is scratched today, it's probably not a problem. So I always look for what's the existing solution to that problem, and why is your solution better at scratching that itch? So it's not that you need a competitor doing the exact same thing. It's that you need something to solve that problem, or else it's probably not really a problem.
That's great. And thinking about my interview with Aaron Walter, which I had recently, and he talked a lot about research and just knowing who your users are. And the best way to know is to talk to them. Just get out of your seat and go and talk to them, especially if you can in their environment.
Yeah. So I would go even one step further. I would say that the best secret weapon you have is to build for yourself. And I think we as designers, we shy away from that sometimes, and I'm not really sure why. That we think, well, my client says I should build this and that. But you remember, you can pick and choose. slavery was abolished now over 100 years ago. We don't have to work for everyone. If you want to do the most impact, if you want to really do the most good in the world, the best thing you can do is to build for a user that you understand intimately. The person you know best is yourself, hopefully.
Yeah, right.
And so that is not, it doesn't, I think it's a fantastic hack to look for clients, to look for projects, to look for the company you work for, where the product that you're building is one that you would actually use. It's a huge, huge advantage. I mean, if you think about who founded Google and Microsoft and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and WhatsApp and Slack and Snapchat, all these companies were founded by people who just wanted the product themselves.
Such a great point.
And they deeply understood the user's needs.
Such a great point. This podcast is a result of that actual thing, because
there you go.
I was like, I'm feeling a little discouraged in this field. It's just so hard to keep up, and I just feel overwhelmed, and what do I have to know? And so it was like, I bet I'm not alone here. I bet I'm not alone. And I created this podcast to keep designers inspired and encouraged to fight on, is what we say, and thankfully it's resonating. So thanks, Defenders, for listening. And, that's a great answer, Nir. I love that. And it's very overlooked. And I think we take the very, very important fact that we're not our users. We take that, and maybe we take it a little too far to where, I actually might use this thing, and actually I would use this thing. I'm creating something that I would use. So this is my pain point, and this is how I'm going to solve that. So I think that's a really great insight.
It's not that you'll fail if you don't build for yourself, right? You can absolutely still build a great product for someone who's not you. It can be done, of course. It's just that you have to work so much harder, right?
So true.
So that's why I call it a hack. It's not a rule. It's a hack.
Yeah. And then what you do is you test your assumptions, build it for yourself, and then test your assumptions with the people that you are targeting with this product. Right. And then that'll inform any tweaks that you need to make.
Right.
So I love that.
It's your chances of success are so much higher. I've seen this happen again and again and again. People take shots in the dark thinking, I think my user might like it. But if you don't know that user intimately, your chances are very low of success.
That's so good. So we're wrapping up here. So I want to ask you, what are you working on next, Nir? And can you talk about it?
That's a good question. Speaking of building something for myself, I mean, the reason I started writing in the first place was to answer questions that I had and wanted to get answers to. And only by sitting and thinking about them deeply could I come to kind of conclusions to answers that were kind of burning on my mind. So like, for example, you know, this whole idea, this question of how do companies build habits, or what are ethical guidelines for what we won't do? These are all questions I had that I just wanted an answer to. And so now I'm kind of in a bit of an exploratory phase. I don't have a huge project to work on right now. If any of your listeners out there have an idea for the kind of book they're looking for that they wish someone would answer, or a big question they wish someone would tackle, I have kind of the luxury of being able to think and research and explore these topics. So I'm kind of looking for the next thing, to be honest.
That's awesome, Nir. You know what? It's humbling that you put that out there to the defenders listening. And you know what? They might take you up on it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So. Please let me know. I have a contact form on my website at nearandfar.com. I'd love to hear from you.
That's so great. So is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to make sure you leave us with, Nir?
No, I think we covered a ton. You asked some great questions.
Oh, good. Well, thanks, man. I had a bunch more, but I want to respect your time, and maybe we'll do like a part two down the road, and maybe with this new project.
Absolutely.
Right on, Nir. This has just been so enlightening. I've learned a ton. I know our listeners have as well, and I know they're going to be connecting with you. And by the way, what's the best way for them to do that? You mentioned your website, and it's nearandfar.com, right? N-I-R?
Right. Near, like my first name, N-I-R, and far, nearandfar.com. And the book is Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and that's available wherever books are sold.
Get the book, Defenders. It is radically life-changing, and it'll enlighten your design process greatly. All right. So
thank you.
Thanks so much, Nir. And I just want to say, fight on, my friend.
Thank you. Likewise. It was a real pleasure. Let me know what I can do to be helpful in the future, okay?
All right. Thanks, bud. Bye.
All right. Take care.
I had such a blast talking with Nir. He's such a fascinating and brilliant guy. I especially love the superhero tie-in as product designers creating habit-forming products. We have this great power, and with great power comes, you guessed it, great responsibility. I've already read Hooked twice. It is that good. And I highly recommend you check it out too, Defenders. And a super convenient way to do that is by listening to it on Audible. I've teamed up with Audible to get you a free audiobook of your choice, including Hooked. Now, all you have to do is visit audibletrial.com/userdefenders. Nir is also offering an official companion workbook to Hooked. You can get it for free by subscribing to his newsletter at nearal.com. If you want to stay abreast, never gets old, to the latest goings-on with the show and be the first to read my usable thoughts, I urge you to subscribe to the bi-weekly Bugle by visiting userdefenders.com/join. Thanks so much for listening, Defenders. It is a great honor to have your ears on a bi-weekly basis. If there's ever anything I can do for you, or if you have ideas for guests, just like this episode was a result of that, or anything else, please don't hesitate to drop me a line at userdefenders@gmail.com. I want to thank Chris Combs for the superhuman editing and Wyman Gentry for the compelling show music. Thanks again so much for listening, and until next time, fight on, my friends.